Now it's time for Power of Prophecy, continuing the legacy of Tex Mars, exposing evil, and promoting Jesus Christ as Savior. Here's your host, Jerry Barrett.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. I'm your host, Jerry Barrett. Honored to have you join me again this week. Before we get started, I want to wish everyone a very happy and prosperous 2024. Happy New Year. It is great to have you tune back in and give me some of your time. I greatly appreciate it. We are going to cover Secrets this week, my favorite program of the month, Secrets Volume Number 327. And the Babylon Bee. I hope that you get a chance to read it. It is a tremendous creator of satire. It is quite funny, unless you're a snowflake, and then it hurts your feelings and makes you mad and you don't want to read it. But it always makes me chuckle. Came across this from the Babylon Bee, and it's entitled The Biden Administration's Top 10 Accomplishments of 2023. Biden accomplished feats in 2023 no one saw coming. There were so many incredible achievements for the Biden administration. And the Bee says narrowing them down was a monumental task. But here they are. Number one, reduced obesity in America by making food unaffordable. How simple is that, right? They cleaned up all the cocaine bags someone left around the White House. Decency has been restored. Number three, kept American hostages free from junk fees during their stay with Hamas. Not one single junk fee. This is in reference to what the Department of Defense is doing to military men and women that are stationed overseas. They're charging them a fee to store their junk. The DOD's words, not mine. Number four, set all-time record for people illegally streaming into the U.S. The Bee says it's because he's the most popular president ever. The numbers don't lie. Number five, raised dementia awareness by 400%. Number six, created record numbers of new billionaires. Now, they're all in Ukraine, but still, record number of new billionaires. Promoted transparency by releasing several behind-the-scenes videos from Capitol staffers. Campaign promise delivered. The Biden administration also saved democracy by arresting political opponents and not allowing people to vote for anyone else. They set a new record by spending 40% of their time on vacation, finally giving Delaware Beach the attention it so richly deserves. And last but not least, heroically stayed alive to save America from a Kamala Harris presidency. Whew! Ain't that the truth? We salute you, Joe Biden. Can't wait to see what you got up your sleeves for 2024. Quite humorous. I wanted to start with that because it lightens the mood, because it is a crazy world out there right now, and it's not getting any better. It seems that morality and decency and common sense are just like Elvis. They have left the building. Here's common sense for you. California, Berkeley, as a matter of fact. Berkeley is one of the most liberal cities in America. In 2019, Berkeley enacted a policy to counter climate change. They banned installing gas-powered appliances in new buildings. Genius, right? I thought they were pumping natural gas as a clean energy. But alas, it's a fossil fuel. Oh no, it's bad for the environment, right? Well, the California Restaurant Association sued the city of Berkeley over this ordinance and originally lost the case in federal court. But a 3-judge panel vindicated the California Restaurant Association in April of 2023. And they reversed this decision. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals refused to revisit this case. It is settled. Even though the Biden administration made a direct appeal to the Ninth Circuit to reinstate this ban by calling this decision erroneous, but good on the Ninth Circuit for not revisiting this, and for the 3-judge panel that voted against this idiotic law. I don't know if you've cooked with electric or gas, but I have used both. I prefer a gas oven, a gas stove, over anything electric. I've never been able to get the heat properly throughout a skillet or a pot or a pan without scorching something. Ever. Maybe I'm not that good a cook, but it just disgusts me to have to cook on our electric stoves. So good on them. Now, this has been rumored to have been coming down the pipe for over a year and a half. They were going to start banning gas stoves. I think they've even done it in New York. The Department of Energy in May of 23 asserted that it was a myth that the federal government wants to ban gas stoves. Really? But you're pushing this law. You want the Ninth Circuit to overturn the 3-court appellate judge ruling. They do want to ban gas stoves. They want to control every facet of your life. Here's another one. This was in the Washington Examiner, written by Breanne Depish. I hope I pronounced that right. New minimum wage increases took effect on January 1st in 22 states that boosted wages for an estimated 10 million workers. The pay increases have been adopted by 43 cities and localities as well. And they're estimating, I love this, they estimate that the wages will increase a combined $7 billion a year. Estimated. That's if everybody stays employed and gets bumped up to the new minimum wage. But what happens with the minimum wage? Your hours get cut or workforce gets reduced. Because the owners are not in business to lose money. Cause and effect. I've talked about this before. The 22 states that increased their minimum wage are California, that went to $16 an hour, Washington State, $16.28, Alaska, $11.73, Hawaii, $14, Montana, $10.30, Arizona, $14.35. Colorado, $14.42. South Dakota, $11.20. Nebraska, $12. Minnesota, $10.85. Missouri, $12.30. Michigan, to $10.33. Illinois, to $14. Ohio, to $10.45. New York to $15, New Jersey to $15.13 because it's better to work in Jersey than New York. Vermont, $13.67. Maine, $14.15. Connecticut, $15.69. Rhode Island, $14. Delaware, $13.45. And Maryland to $15 an hour. Now, I don't know about you, but I have noticed a trend. In the Austin area, the minimum wage here, I think, is still what the federal government has said at $7.35 an hour, something like that. Maybe $7.50, whatever it is. But the market will pay and adjust to more than minimum wage. I know there are kids flipping burgers for $15 an hour in Austin now. Now, the burgers are $10 a piece, and they're not good burgers, but they're 10 bucks a piece because they got to pay these kids to actually show up and do a little bit of labor. Employees nationwide have struggled financially because of higher costs due to the inflation imposed with Bidenomics. Inflation rose to a 40-year high in 2022. Now, it did kind of taper in 2023, but whoop-de-doo, right? I mean, you're already up a 40-year high in 2022, so it thankfully had to come down. But in a rebuttal by Rachel Gresler in the Daily Signal, Rachel writes, 60% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Most U.S. households could use a raise, but a one-size-fits-all increase in the minimum wage that was imposed by lawmakers in Washington and 21 other states will only exacerbate the struggles of these households. Now, they're pushing for this in D.C. as well, and the Congressional Budget Office did an analysis of federal minimum wage increases and the proposed legislation that is out there that will increase the minimum wage to $17 an hour, which will make Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez giddy, will reduce employment and increase prices, interest rates, and federal deficits. Now, this is according to analysis by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, people that Congress should be listening to. Right now, 1.9 million fewer people are employed today than if the employment to population ratio were where it was in February of 2020. The CBO estimates that at $17 an hour minimum wage, 700,000 jobs among low-income workers will be lost. Now, that's an estimate by the CBO. The CBO also calculated a 33% chance that job losses will exceed 1.4 million workers. What are minimum wage jobs? They play an important role as a stepping stone into the workforce and gives an opportunity to individuals with disabilities, limited English, or a criminal record to get their foot in the door. That's what minimum wage was originally intended for. Low-paying jobs for unskilled workers to get their foot in the door and start learning either a skill, a trade, or as a teenager, gas money to go back and forth to dates and things of that nature. A massive hike in this minimum wage could act as a barrier to entry into the workforce. So what is that going to do? That's going to leave all of these unskilled laborers without a job. It'll be less output from American workers. The economy will shrink. Income taxes will shrink the collection of, and welfare spending will go through the roof. The Congressional Budget Office estimates federal deficits will increase by $59 billion, with a B, $59 billion between 2024 and 2033 because of this proposed federal minimum wage hike. But if this goes through, you need to expect that prices will increase because the owners of these businesses have to pay people more to do the same job, or they'll have to reduce the workforce, which will, once again, increase the welfare state. Childcare costs can be expected to raise by 20% because you got to pay somebody to watch little Johnny and little Janie. Over the past 3 years, thanks to Bidenflation, mortgage interest rates have nearly tripled because the Federal Reserve has raised rates to combat the government's spending. The CBO estimates that interest rates will rise slightly under the proposed hike in the minimum wage. It also estimates the federal government's nearly $34 trillion debt. If they bump this to $17 an hour minimum wage, the debt is going to add $14 billion more in interest costs. Now, if these learned people that have been duly elected, and I say that tongue in cheek, because anybody that seems to get into Congress, especially if they're leaning left, have no concept of reality. But if they want to increase workers' wages and opportunities, they need to eliminate government-created barriers to work and higher wages. If you eliminate unnecessary regulations that drive up business costs and reduce workers' wages, booyah, you got a winner. The policies of less government intervention were introduced from 2017 to 2019 during the Trump administration. Earnings increased 9.9% for low-income workers. I've talked about this numerous times. The fact that people were finally getting a decent wage, a raise. The wages were stagnant during the Obama administration. They had been stagnant under W because of government regulation. But we put a businessman, crooked or not, into the White House. Next thing you know, wages went up. Wages went up 4.8% for the median worker, the middle class. But in contrast, amid massive government spending and a slew of new labor regulations from 21 to 23, thanks to Joe Biden's administration, real earnings increased only 4.8% for low-income workers, and the median worker earnings fell 1%. So which program worked better? Trump's or Biden's? You tell me. Here we go back to Cali. There is a new law that Gavin Newsom signed in California that requires law enforcement agencies to use preferred names and gender pronouns of alleged criminals when their mugshots are posted on social media. That's right. The law reads, quote, "With respect to an individual who has been arrested for any crime, this bill will require a police department or sheriff's office, upon posting a booking photo on social media, use the name and pronouns given by the individual arrested. In addition, the law now restricts how long some mugshots can remain on social media. The bill will require a police department or sheriff's office to remove any booking photo shared on social media after 14 days unless specified circumstances exist. And this law is retroactive. So any mugshot that was posted online by any California law enforcement agency had to be removed if it was shared prior to December 17th. The 14-day period. Gender pronouns now are required. Not birth names, but new names that they have picked out of thin air because they are gender fluid. Idiocracy. Speaking of idiocracy, in a recent column for the National Review, Dr. Richard Bosshart, a renowned surgeon, criticized the American College of Surgeons for intensifying its commitment to anti-racist initiatives. That's right, DEI. Dr. Bosshart wrote, quote, "America's surgeons are not woke enough, according to the American College of Surgeons. The ACS, the largest surgical organization in the country, recently introduced a diversity, equity, and inclusion toolkit for providers. Earlier this month, the ACS announced that the toolkit would provide a blueprint for implementing equitable practices in the medical field. Dr. Bosshart contends that the organization is compromising the quality of medical training and patient care by focusing on concepts such as microaggressions, implicit bias, and white privilege." Dr. Bosshart said, quote, "The toolkit is an exhaustive compilation of everything related to pushing the narrative of systemic and structural racism as the source of disparities, including minority representation within the ACS and clinical outcomes in minority surgical patients." Close quote. Dr. Bossart criticized the toolkit for using flawed studies to propagate the unbelievably toxic notion that racism permeates surgery and results in inferior outcomes for black patients. Bossart also pointed out that the toolkit advocates for implicit racial bias training to combat racism despite research debunking its effectiveness. But Dr. Bossart expressed that the most concerning aspect of the toolkit is its requirement for surgeons to categorize patients into racial identity groups. Quote, "The traditional tenets of Hippocratic medicine, which focus on the individual in front of the physician, have been, for all intents and purposes, abandoned." He warned that the emphasis on DEI and anti-racism could have a detrimental impact on medicine by consuming valuable training time for surgeons, thereby putting patients at risk. Dr. Bossart's already observed a decline in the quality of medical care due to these policies. He said, quote, "I have spoken to many of my surgical peers, and we agree that we are already seeing an erosion of quality in surgery, with many programs turning out surgeons who are not ready to practice independently. I have spoken to surgical residents who report a sense that they are not getting the necessary hands-on clinical and surgical experience to feel confident, while being simultaneously tasked with assimilating and regurgitating anti-racist and DEI ideology." How scary is that if you have future medical needs and these surgeons aren't qualified because they're too busy worrying about anti-racism, diversity, equity, inclusion? Surgeons no longer take the Hippocratic Oath, from what I'm understanding, but now they have to pledge to the God of wokeness. It's not going to be a good ending. Speaking of not being a good ending, I saw a clip with the GOP presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy being talked to or interviewed by a Washington Post reporter. The Post reporter demanded for a woke fealty test from Ramaswamy, and he dismantled this idiot. You got to hear this. It's about a minute and a half long. The reporter snarkily commented, quote, "You didn't say you condemn white supremacy," close quote. And this is Ramaswamy's response.
I'm not going to recite some catechism for you. I'm against vicious racial discrimination in this country. So I'm not pledging allegiance to your new religion of modern wokeism, which absolutely fits the test. I'm not going to bend the knee to your religion. I'm sorry. I'm not asking you to bend the knee to mine, and I'm not going to bend the knee to yours. But do I condemn vicious racial discrimination? Yes, I do. Am I going to play your silly game of gotcha? No, I'm not. And frankly, this is why people have lost trust. And I know you're going to go print the headline tomorrow. I already know this. We already know how your game works. Vivek Ramaswamy refuses to condemn white supremacy because you asked a stupid question. The reality is, I condemn vicious racial discrimination in this country, but the kind of vicious and systematic racial discrimination we see today is discrimination on the basis of race in a very different direction. You want to know what the best way is to end discrimination on the basis of race? Stop discriminating on the basis of race. Do that, and we're going to move this country forward. And I don't care whether you're black or white or brown or anything in between. That's how we're going to unite this country. You people have been responsible for dividing this country to a breaking point, creating a projection of national division. I meet people from the south side of Chicago to meetings like this one of every shade of melanin, multiple from man to woman, doesn't make a difference, who are hungry for reviving unity in this country. And you, with your catechism that you try to get to politicians to whatever fake headline you're going to print on the basis of this conversation tomorrow, that's what's dividing this country to a breaking point. Shame on you. Look people in the eye and tell them what you've actually failed to tell them for the last 5 years. Own the accountability for your own failures as the media. That's how we rebuild trust in this country. And until then, I don't have a lot of patience to play the games.
Amazing, right? You people are responsible for dividing this country to a breaking point. That is what controlled media has been doing. Everything is about race. It started under the Obama administration, and it hasn't gotten any better. Speaking of not getting any better, this was in Blabber Buzz. I talked about this when it passed. In 2020, Measure 110 up in Oregon passed by nearly 60% of Oregon voters, and it decriminalized personal use of all drugs and redirecting a significant portion of the state's marijuana tax revenue to fund addiction services. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control, drug overdoses claim the lives of over 100,000 people across America in 2022, marking a 45% increase since 2019. Now, in the wake of this liberal drug law, there is a coalition of political and business leaders who are calling for reform and threatening to bring a ballot measure to voters if the state's legislators fail to act by early 2024. Recent polls show Oregonians are growing increasingly disillusioned with this Measure 110. Polls this year show 74% of residents favored recriminalizing possession of fentanyl, heroin, and meth, and making treatment mandatory rather than voluntary. 86% of respondents expressed support for an immediate ban on the public use of hard drugs. I guess their grand experiment failed. When Measure 110 was enacted, possession of small amounts of drugs was only punishable by a $100 fine. Oregon Judicial Department data reveals that less than 1% of those ticketed completed a treatment evaluation. Decriminalization did not create Oregon's current overdose crime and livability issues, but it exacerbated every one of these situations. Even libtard Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler has urged lawmakers to criminalize public drug use, and downtown business owners blame the law for turning the city into a virtual drug supermarket. Legalizing drugs never has been a good thing, and it still isn't. Open-air drug use. Oh, man. This was in POTUSToast.com. Now, some people stick out like a sore thumb as false teachers and hypocrites. It's a sad truth about churchianity. But it should come as no surprise that people like this are present in the church because Jesus said there would be. Some of these false teachers get caught in something bad, but they're allowed to continue on with their ministry as though nothing ever happened. Look at Creflo Dollar. He was arrested for domestic abuse, and he still makes billions through deceiving his church. There is another Georgia pastor who is in serious trouble, but it's even worse than what Creflo Dollar did. This pastor and his wife were arrested on 8 counts of false imprisonment. He and his wife had 8 people illegally locked up in their basement. They range in ages from 25 to 65 years old. His name is Curtis Keith Bankston, and his wife is Sophia Sim Bankston. They were running an unlicensed group home out of their rented home in Griffin, Georgia. It was under the guise of a church known as One Step of Faith, Second Chance. Well, the Griffin Fire Department was called to the house, and there was a report that someone was having a seizure. When the firefighters arrived, they noticed a deadbolt on the door. Their crews had to climb through a window to reach the patient. Investigators determined the people in the basement, all with mental or physical disabilities or both, were essentially imprisoned against their will, which created an extreme hazard as the individuals could not exit the residence if there were an emergency. The Bankstons controlled the finances, medications, and public benefits of the people they were keeping locked in the basement, and sometimes denied their medications and medical care, according to the police. Wolves in sheep's clothing, so-called pastors, imprisoning people and taking money. What a sad state of affairs. Well, that's going to take care of the first half. I want to thank you for tuning in. We're going to have to take a brief pause, and when I come back, we're going to dive right back into a whole lot more secrets. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. Stay with us, won't you? I'll be right back. Hello, friends. Jerry Barrett back with you again. I want to tell you about an outstanding book that we offer, authored by Frank L. Britton, entitled Behind communism. Here is persuasive, unassailable proof that it was Jewish revolutionaries who invented and supervised the horrors and ravages of communist totalitarianism. Karl Marx, a Zionist Jew, was inspired by Moses Hess, a Zionist Jew, to formulate the dogma of the communist system. Then Lenin, a Zionist Jew, teamed up with Trotsky, a Zionist Jew, and other Illuminati Zionist Jews to seize the Russian Empire and turn it into a massive, bloody, killing and torture factory rivaling anything that George Orwell could have ever conceived. In this groundbreaking book, you will be shocked to discover what and who is behind communism. It's 128 pages. We're only asking $15. Please add $6 shipping and handling. That'll make your total $21 for Behind Communism. You can order your copy by phoning us toll-free in the United States and Canada at 1-800-234-9673. If you care to phone us on our regular line, that number is 512-263-9780. We're in the office Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Time. We accept Visa, MasterCard, Discover, and American Express. You can use those same charge cards at our secure shopping cart by going to powerofprophecy.com. There's an ad for Behind Communism right there on the main page. Click on it, put in your name, address, charge card, shipping method, hit submit. We'll get it and get it coming to you. If you want to send in a check, money order, or cash, please make your check or money order payable to Power of Prophecy, and you can mail it to us here at 4819 R.O. Drive, Suite 102, Spicewood, Texas, and our zip code is 78669. $21 postpaid for Behind Communism. Okay, and now let's return to our regular program. Today we're covering Secrets, volume number 327. You know, Biden administration has pushed electric vehicles or EVs, whatever you want to call them, down our throats. And a lot of the left-leaning states and localities have acquiesced, as well as the manufacturers. Ford, GM, they're pumping and pushing people to buy these EVs, but it's tailed off. I wonder why. Well, it's not just cars, but it's also buses. But in Maine, can you imagine Maine, small little state up in the Northeast, pushing the same agenda on EVs as California? But if you've done any research into the heating and cooling that you can get out of an EV and how it affects the life of the battery and the distance that you can travel, it's amazing. Well, we're finding out now that cold weather and these batteries don't mix. And it's in more than one facet, which is it's basic physics. If you think about it, the Maine Board of Environmental Protection was set to meet and discuss finalizing the California-style electric vehicle mandate to begin in 2027 and force 82% of new vehicles to have zero emissions by 2032. The meeting was indefinitely postponed. Why? Well, the state was hit with rain and wind that left over 400,000 residents without power. 400,000. There's only 1.3 million in the state. So one in three people was without power. So imagine a weather emergency where one in three people were left without viable access to gasoline and or a gasoline-powered vehicle. Maine Democratic Rep. Jared Golden said, quote, "Forcing Mainers to purchase cars and trucks powered by electricity when our grid is insufficient, charging stations are few and far between, and a storm would render 80% of cars useless is, to say the least, ill-advised, close quote. Well, the governor of Maine seems dead set on making this happen, but obviously hasn't considered the problems with Maine's electrical grid that will be exacerbated by all of these EVs plugged in at one time. Never mind that the same people who say we desperately need to switch to EVs insist that internal combustion engines are causing extreme weather events to be more common. Also, never mind they generally also refuse to consider nuclear power as a sustainable option. They want to make you dependent upon EVs, even though they know the state electrical grid is fragile, and assume weather is going to get progressively worse. Not the sharpest tools in the shed that you've elected up there in Maine, is it? Or Michigan or California? Minnesota? Up here in Minnesota, MinnPost reported, several of the state's largest cities have encountered significant obstacles in their quest to achieve planet-friendly public transportation. That's right, frigid temperatures and a myriad of other problems have plagued Duluth and Minneapolis-St. Paul during their transition to zero-emission buses in sub-zero conditions, which is what routinely happens in winter in Minnesota. Electric buses operate at only a fraction of their proposed 150-mile capacity. Drew Kerr, the spokesman for Twin Cities Metro Transit, explained, quote, using garage chargers alone, electric buses can remain in service for 70 to 75 miles before needing to return to the garage. With on-route chargers, electric buses were scheduled to be in service for up to 90 miles before returning to the garage. But the Duluth spokesman Dave Clark noted the city has experienced significant problems with charging stations. Quote, they would fail. They would not perform. They would experience malfunctions, glitches. They were extremely problematic right out of the gate, close quote. Furthermore, Duluth's bus fleet has provided inadequate comfort by failing to keep riders warm in the winter. The Twin Cities fleet has proven comparably unreliable. In Minneapolis-St. Paul, electric buses have broken down at twice the rate of traditional diesel-powered buses. In 2021, Metro Transit received a federal grant to purchase a fleet of EV buses from California-based manufacturer Proterra. Duluth received a similar grant in 2015. But you know what happened early 2023? Proterra filed for bankruptcy, despite the public endorsement of resident Joe Biden. Not going the distance that they said it would. Chargers breaking down. Oh, here's another one. This was in BlabberBuzz as well. A ballot harvester who was convicted, appointed as vice mayor. This is in San Luis, Arizona. Gloria Torres is the new vice mayor. But Torres was found guilty of ballot abuse in June of 2023, she was charged for her involvement in a ballot harvesting scheme that was uncovered through an investigation by the Arizona Attorney General's Office. The investigation was prompted by an expose by local figures who set up a hidden camera and captured incriminating video surveillance outside a San Luis polling station. Gloria Torres was indicted with two Class 6 felonies for conspiracy and ballot abuse. She received a 2-year probation sentence when she pled guilty to ballot abuse. But those in power in San Luis, Arizona, deemed her worthy of being named vice mayor. Oh, idiocy runs deep. Oh, I don't know if you saw this. It was on local news. Also, I found it searching the web, looking for articles for this program. But in Nevada, Las Vegas specifically. Did you see the video? This judge was about to render sentence to a career thug when he went nuts, jumped over the bench, tackled the judge, and beat on her before he could be pulled off. That's right. He's a convicted felon, long history of violent crime. His name is Deobra Redden. And during the hearing before he went nuts, he claimed he was in a better place in his mind and has a better support system and a new job. He said, quote, "I feel like I shouldn't be sent to prison, but if it's appropriate for you, then you got to do what you got to do," close quote. His attorney argued for a suspended sentence and noted previous completions of probation programs. But Judge Mary Kay Holtis wasn't having it. She said, quote, "I appreciate that, but I think it's time that he got a taste of something else because I just can't with that history," close quote. He cursed her. Then he took off running, jumped over the bench, and attacked the judge. It is amazing video. He was booked into Clark County Jail on charges of battery and battery of a protected person. Oh, my. He is a 30-year-old, three-time convicted felon who has received probation multiple times and even bit a woman. He has 9 misdemeanor convictions on his record as well. Here is a rundown of this guy who is reformed, rehabilitated, ready to be a normal member in society. Not. In 2012, convicted of assault causing bodily injury to a family member. 45 days in jail. In 2013, convicted 3 times for domestic battery. He attended anger management classes, spent 2 months in jail, and paid a fine. In 2014, convicted for attempted theft, he was sentenced to probation, which he violated several times. He then entered a mental health court program. While on probation, he was twice convicted of domestic battery, tampered with his alcohol monitoring device, and violated other terms. He was also charged with kicking a police officer in the knee. In 2018, Redden was convicted of battery with substantial bodily harm during probation after he bit a woman and broke windows of a man's car with a rock. He again was sentenced to probation. A judge honorably discharged him from probation in 2020 and 2021. He was convicted again for domestic battery in 2021. A different judge sentenced Redden to prison for 12 to 30 months. He was granted parole in 2022. In 2021, Redden was charged by police with attempted home invasion and destroying the property of another person. In January of 2021, Redden appeared before Holtis again. This is 2021 when he appeared before her. He pled guilty, and Holtis released him on no bail. A month later, he was sentenced to a year of probation. In October, he violated this probation and was ordered to serve 106 days in jail. You know what needs to happen to this guy? Lock him up. Throw away the key. Don't let him out. He obviously cannot conform to societal norms. But soft on crime prosecutors and judges are fomenting even more issues with the general public. We're not safe anymore. Now, have you heard of the term Wolf of Wall Street? His name is Jordan Belfort. He earned this nickname, but he's done his time, and now he's calling out suspicious timing of stock transactions, and if he's doing that, you know it's got to be pretty bad. He appeared on Tucker Carlson on Twitter, or X, whatever you want to call it, and you would think that Jordan Balfour would know a shady stock dealing when he saw it. So during the interview, he said, "It's awful funny how former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and her husband Paul, a businessman and founder of the investment firm Financial Leasing Services, seem to consistently beat seasoned pros." You have to listen to Jordan Belfort talking about Pelosi, and it's just eye-opening.
You can get rich in the stock market, but not overnight. It's just it doesn't work. You can't do that. And if you try to get rich by engaging in short-term trading or picking like one stock, you're probably going to end up in the financial poorhouse.
Is Nancy Pelosi, do you think, a stock-picking genius?
No, she has to be operating on information that's non-public or is not.
Wouldn't that make her a criminal?
Yeah, but you know, look at Joe Biden right now. I mean, look what's going on right now. Like, yeah.
Do you think he's a good stock picker?
Joe Biden? No, I think he's great at laundering money, though.
Yeah,
I mean, honestly,
apparently.
From what I've seen right now, I don't get it. Like, just imagine if it was Trump who was president.
Yeah.
What every single day in the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post, and every other publication would be like. $40,000 check for $20,000 check from his brother. Like, it'd be game over. Cries for impeachment.
Oh, yeah.
It'd be like the world falling down. He's in China's pocket. But it's like we're living in an alternative universe right now where people in power, especially on the left, right, can operate almost with impunity. And Pelosi's a perfect example. She's not the only one, but it's inconceivable that someone could have that high return in the market when everyone else can't do it. So what's the edge? The edge is she knows key legislation. And also, you know, maybe someone's whispering in her ear, okay, because, you know, they want to be on her good side, right? So it's hard to prove.
But it's just prima facie, though. So if what you're saying is true, and that is that the most sophisticated people in the world can't beat the S&P average,
right.
Then any member of Congress, and I think they are on average dumber than the population.
Especially the career politicians.
For sure.
Yeah.
There's no possibility they could do that with that inside information.
No, it's not possible. But again, so how do you go proving that, right? They have to issue subpoenas. And listen, I think that in this case, the solution is they shouldn't be allowed to trade these people.
Yes.
They should not be allowed to trade. It's insane that they're allowed to. So listen, she's done incredibly well in an area where like the most professional investors struggle to even match the index. So somehow she's doing three times as well. I don't know. SEC is not going to look into that sort of stuff because they don't want to make an enemy because they're funded. Who funds them? You know, they're funded by Congress. The budget's tied to Congress, right? There's a committee it's the Financial Services Committee, right? So that funds the SEC.
They fund the SEC. So of course they're not going to make Pelosi mad. So let's just take a look at some of the trades that Nancy and her husband Paul have made. May to June of 2021, Paul bought up to $11 million worth of tech stocks before a suite of antitrust legislation endorsed by Nancy was moved forward on by the House. His curiously timed transaction managed to bring in $5.3 million alone from a purchase of stock of Alphabet, the parent company of Google. June of 2022, Paul Pelosi bought 20,000 shares of a semiconductor company as the America Competes Act subsidized U.S. semiconductor production was working its way through Congress. In December of 2022, Paul Pelosi dumped 10,000 shares of Google stock just before Biden's Department of Justice filed an antitrust lawsuit against Google. It's pretty obvious. I've done a program exposing Nancy Pelosi and all of the shenanigans that she's pulled. It's a criminal enterprise, her and Paul. And they're getting rich on the backs of Americans. Insider trading. Yeah. You try it. Tell me if the Department of Justice doesn't come crashing in your door. Well, here's an article from Gateway Pundit written by Jim Hoff. Taylor Hansen is a journalist. He covered protests, the open border, pornographic porn shows open to children. On January 6th of 2021, Taylor was reporting at the Capitol. He attended protests in D.C. on the 5th. On January 6th, Taylor was in the crowd with the police indiscriminately and without warning, firing on the Trump crowd outside the Capitol. Taylor even helped put out a man on fire after he was hit by a projectile fired by the police. Taylor was also inside the building as a credentialed reporter when Ashley Babbitt was murdered by Officer Byrd. Taylor wrote for the Gateway Pundit for a period of time in 2021. In an article that Taylor wrote, he laid out what really happened, and it's completely different from the current media narrative. But this article has since been mentioned in government reports. A whistleblower sent Taylor evidence the government was trailing him for 2 years on at least 12 flights with 48 different air marshals. It shows, this document shows 12 different flights Taylor took after January 21 protests in D.C., and it's marked Hansen was one of the individuals who trespassed in the U.S. Capitol on January 6th. He posted a video. He was next to the person who was shot and provided an interview on Laura Ingraham's show stating he was in the building. He has violent tendencies. CH includes charges of resisting a law enforcement officer. A journalist, an honest journalist, followed by air marshals, surveilled by our federal government. Makes you warm and fuzzy, doesn't it? Here's another one on POTUS Toast, entitled The Latest Secret Surveillance Program Spying on Millions of Americans. Big Brother's doing it again. There is a secret surveillance program called Data Analytical Services, or DAS. It has been quietly collecting and analyzing over a trillion domestic phone records within the U.S. each year. Who's behind this? Would you be shocked if I told you AT&T? They are in cahoots with federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. Innocent people minding their own business are having their phone records scrutinized by authorities without any judicial oversight or public accountability. This program, formerly known as Hemisphere, uses a technique called chain analysis. It doesn't just target those in direct phone contact with criminal suspects, but anyone those individuals have been in contact with as well. That's why it's called Hemisphere, huh? Because it doesn't matter. They're going after everybody. They're listening to everyone. The Fourth Amendment right is supposed to protect us from unreasonable searches and seizures. But it doesn't seem to be in effect with this program, does it? Our rights are being just tossed out the window. AT&T has voluntarily chosen to cooperate with law enforcement, providing training on how to use this system. And who's footing the bill? John Q. Taxpayer. This program is funded by the White House's Office of National Drug Control Policy. But don't just think it's Biden. President Trump resumed funding for this program in 2017. It ran for 4 years. It didn't stop until 2021. And Biden resumed it once more without comment on its legality or implications. Now, there are ongoing lawsuits that are challenging this, but don't hold your breath. Don't hold your breath. Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House press secretary. If you watch the news, you see her on there. Peter Ducey from Fox usually gets under her skin pretty good. and he calls her out for the lies and the misstatements and misleading statements that constantly come out of her pie hole. Well, it's a new year, but it's not a new Karine Jean-Pierre. No, she's blasting Governor Abbott for sending migrants, illegal immigrants to sanctuary cities. She was on CNN, and she was asked by anchor Audie Cornish about complaints by mayors of Democrat cities who are drowning in the deluge of asylum seekers that were invited to enter the United States illegally by Biden's refusal to secure the borders. Of course, KJP deflects the responsibility from its rightful place and blames Texas Governor Greg Abbott specifically for transporting these migrants to Democrat-run cities in the north. Recall not long ago, these same people were saying, hey, we're a sanctuary city. We'll take all your migrants.
So here's my response. It is shameful that a Republican governor, Governor Abbott in Texas, is using migrants as a political stunt. The busing of migrants, the putting them on flights, it is shameful that that is occurring. And instead of, if the governor really truly wants to deal with this issue, he should talk to the senators in his state and actually ask them to work with us.
Abbott has reached out. He's tried to talk to the White House to explain what's going on. He's only sending a small percentage of illegal immigrants to these Democrat-run sanctuary cities. El Paso is even busing illegal immigrants to New York. That was a secret deal from one Democrat mayor to another. But, oh, it's okay when a Democrat does it to another Democrat, but when a Republican governor does it and publicizes it, whoa, we got to do something about this. But Biden's administration's been doing this secretively since at least the beginning of 2022. How many planes, if you've done the research, you know that they had contracted planes to shuttle these migrants to red states, Florida, one of them. In 2020, the border under Trump at least achieved a semblance of order. Newsweek, the liberal fish rag that that place is, even acknowledged in a September 2022 report. Quote, migrant encounters during the Trump administration generally trended downward after he instituted the Remain in Mexico policy. Even Newsweek admitted that it wasn't this bad under Trump. But I urge you to remember what de Blasio, what Lori Lightfoot, the then mayor of Chicago, said. They wouldn't cooperate with ICE. They said it's not fair that these illegal immigrants haven't committed a crime and they're being sent to these Democrat-run cities. Blah, 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 blah. Goodness gracious. Well, I want to finish with this one. It was in BearingArms.com. Cam Edwards wrote it. There were anti-gun activists who predicted the passage of constitutional carry legislation was going to turn Ohio into the wild, wild west. Well, since it's become enacted, I guess you could say Ohio is the mild west. Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost announced that a new study from the Center for Justice Research at Bowling Green University found a decline in gun-related crime in six of the state's eight biggest cities since this law took effect. They analyzed data spanning from June of 21 to June of 23, a year before the law took effect and a year after, and they focused on crimes involving firearms, gunshot detection alerts, and the number of officers who were struck by gunfire. Their study results showed a significant decrease in the number of crimes involving firearms in Akron, Columbus, and Toledo, and across all eight cities combined. The rate of gun crime in Parma, Ohio, fell the most by 22%. Akron and Toledo decreased by 18%. Researchers concluded that constitutional carry has had a minimal effect on crime rates involving firearms, the number of shots detected, and law enforcement officer injuries and deaths, and generally show a decrease in those incidents. But they're quick to say that's not to say permitless carry is responsible for the drop in crime. But permitless carry didn't result in Ohio becoming a more dangerous place, which is what the anti-gun lawmakers and activists kept saying. The reason gun-free zones are dangerous places to be is because only criminals care not about that gun-free zone law. It's a target-rich environment for these psychopaths. Why would you go into a gun-rich environment and pull out a gun and threaten to rob people? Because somebody else can defend themselves. Oh, I don't know what's happened to this country. Common sense has left the building. I want to thank you for tuning in and giving me an hour of your time. I greatly appreciate it. And as always, I pray you will tune in again next week at this same time. Tune in and discover the power of prophecy.